Blog Talk Radio.
For the next little while, Dale Graham. Thank you for coming back, and welcome to anybody who's new to the program. We're going to be dealing with things that connect a bit between the Royal Society and Freemasonry, and pick up some of the work that we were doing last week, some of the information on how to live. And continue on with some of the talk about the tracing boards. And I also want to, if you're okay with it, talk a bit about a phrase that we use continuously, and often the meaning of it is lost to us. It's about the phrase ancient and accepted. I want to talk a bit about the idea of where the exception, what the exception is and where it came from. We might as well know, because we are of that that cut. It's a glorious gray day snowing around me right now. This is the 342nd day of the year, 2013. It's December 8th. This is the 50th week of the year, of course. And the year happens to be 93.7% gone. Hard to believe, isn't it? It's an interesting time. I want to if we can just go through a little bit of Masonic timelines. Want to know, there is a website called Masonic Timelines. You might want to check it out. It's kind of interesting. Look under mastermason.com. And it tells such wondrous things as, although we have some mythical characters, we have birthdays for them. So I'm not kidding. So anyway, broaden your horizon, stretch your imagination, and sit back for the next little while, and we'll see where we go with this. Okay. Thanks for the response to last week's program. It was wonderful and encouraging. I think from the feedback we received to the show on the Higgs boson, that was apparently that had served some purpose. So I'll skim a little bit through thousands of years of history with you, just so that you talking points over your glass of wine and your at your Christmas soirees and the bacchanalia. Oh, you work these things into the conversation. I'm sure it'll be really astound your guests and hosts. 1000 BC, of course, is the year that Hiram Abiff was born. The exact date is unknown, but let's be kind. And about 967 BC was when the building of King Solomon's temple actually began. Well, we know there was a temple. Freemasonry has worked that into the mythology. Wonderful, of course, we won't get into all of that, but the wonderful story that it reveals. And in 960, the construction of the temple was completed. So, the history doesn't fit with the storyline, but the storyline is what it is. It's supposed to convey information in a very symbolic way, and I think it does that remarkably. 715 BC, Numa Pompilius, the second king of Rome, organized Roman workers into various collegia. He attached one to each legion of the army so that Roman arms and arts go hand in hand in the outlying parts of the empire. The stone workers or masons are the most numerous because of their use in defense works, and so became the most powerful. and each collegia had at least three members. They used their tools as symbols to and look after the widows and orphans of members. That's 715 BC. So if you're pressed, does Freemasonry have connections? Well, yes, again, according to, in the same line of thinking that Rome and Greece has a connection with the Parliament of Canada, yes, of course. But you want to, when you have this sense of history, it puts it, it makes it much more appealing because it gives you a sense of that context. Now, the temple that was built in 960 was destroyed in 587 BC. An interesting part of our Masonic history is that in 582 BC, Pythagoras was born. Now, we know he did not weather well after his death. A lot of his the artifacts and symbols of his college, his school, were destroyed. In 300 BC, this is referred to as the Age of Euclid, and the Greek mathematician and geometrician who founded the school at Alexandria, of course. Now, in 290 BC, the Emperor Diocletian executes the stonemasons Claudius, Castorius, Semperianus, Nestromanus, and Simplus, an apprentice, for refusing to carve a statue of a pagan god. Now, this has to do with the story of the Ars Quattro Coronati. So, you know, just think about that. A little bit of history. And how do we remember these parts of history? Well, the same way you and I were taught our cultural mores and values in myths and fairy tales, Hansel and Gretel and the Red Riding Hood, they're all conveying messages that have been passed down through our culture for hundreds and hundreds of years. So you see, this is where, remember, the Emperor 290 and was executing the stonemasons for refusing to carve a statue. And at the time of Christ, there exists in Palestine three religious sects, the Essenes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. The Essenes are the strictest, with a high moral code, a secret ceremony, and a great similarity in character to the craft today. Now, this is said in all seriousness, no tongue-in-cheek. It is sometimes argued that Christ was a member of the Essenes in his formative years up to manhood when he commenced to general preaching. He never spoke against the Essenes, but did against the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now, remember, at the time, there were a number of people that were in that area who claimed to be the Savior. So, and who had some very powerful messages. Christ was one of them at the time. So that's a little bit of the history of the context of this fellow that did exist here. Upon the fall of the Roman Empire, though, many collegia, remember, that were created in 715, this is going on, left, you know, migrate to the island of Como and preserve the stonemason's art. They later emerged as the Comacine builders to construct the many cathedrals during the Middle Ages from 500 AD until 1390 AD. And this, of course, you can imagine the debate that would start. But there you have it. In 926 AD, Prince Edwin, the son of King Athelstan, calls and presides over a meeting of masons at York. Again, we're getting into operative, remember? So all these references, we start to lose in the midst of time that movement into speculative masonry. But where the ideas come from is certainly something that we can trace. 1088, all of this conjecture, of course. Well, all of this up for discussion, not necessarily conjecture. A group of organized operative stonemasons in Germany are in existence, and they're called the Steinmetzen. And some claim they are the precursors of Freemasonry today. Now, the Steinmetzen no longer exist, but they had a rigid, when you read about them, study them, they were very rigid. There were exacting penalties. There were, it was a scripted process, a fraternal order. And I won't bend your or pull, try to pull your opinion away, but to my mind, I'm thinking that because of the strictness, it may have been one of the reasons why the Steinmetz do not exist today. By comparison, then, I'm saying the Masonic order has a fluidity and a flexibility. It may drive some to distraction, but it's in that flexibility is strength. That has allowed craft masonry to prevail for thousands. Well, really, we're looking at let's lop it off and say 1,000 years. 1136, the Melrose Abbey Church is in the process of construction, and traveling masons leave their marks on some of the stones. Great stuff. And that was before, that was even before 1215, the Magna Carta, which was signed by King John and established some of the basic rights for men, free and bonded men, like you and I. The 1271, the Compagnie of France has been in existence for several hundred years, and some suggestions have been made that they are the foundation of modern Freemasonry. If I tend to think that we should take seriously some of the things that were going on in that part of the world in terms of Freemasonry, don't be caught up just in thinking that we're looking bound by English or Gaelic in the development of Freemasonry because the Gauls have certainly had a significant role. Even in the development of our constitution much later, much around the early 18th century. 1278, the use of the word lodge appears in the records of Vale Royal Abbey. So, and then I'll skip a little bit here. 1350, the Statute of Laborers is passed, and it regulates the wages of workmen, and it prevents the escalation of wages due to the shortage of experienced workers. So this is like that market, the market demand. If there's few skilled workers, their wages could climb. So this is capping, And so put a cap on that escalation. If there was a shortage of experienced wages and the great amount of construction work available, so there was a huge amount. So you went shopping. If you needed somebody with talent, the thinking was, well, you just take a bag of coins here and you have a bigger bag and you get the fellow. Well, they didn't want to have that. So we see market control. In this statute, the words mason and freestone appear. And a tracing house is in use at Windsor Castle. Tracing house. I have to go and look at that. And then the London Masons regulations were enacted in 1356. And when I think about it in historical reference, it's not that long ago, but it was a while ago. London's Masons regulations were regulating the building trades of the period. And it contains no mention of organized groups, but it does have the earliest records of apprenticeships. So 1360, remember these. Again, another showstopper at the party tonight. 13 sheriffs were ordered by the Crown to send 568 masons to work on Windsor Castle. So there you have. 1370, the York Minster Masons Ordinance is passed, and it's written in Middle English. Lovely, I don't have my Middle English translator here, but it contains the words mason and mason, M-A-S-O-U-N. Now, 1375, the City of London had already been established, but the Masons Company of London was represented in the Court of Common Council. It must have been in existence for some years to be entitled to this representation. And it had a bit of a standing. And 1376, the Freemason and Mason Company of London is in existence, probably as a craft guild. And this is the first known use of the word Freemason recorded in the City of London Letter Book H, dated the 9th of August in 1376. The word is later stricken off and replaced by the word Mason. There you go. Just to avoid confusion, the next references will become much more familiar. I'm sure the Regius poem or manuscript, because it was sitting in the royal vaults, not deliberately. It's also known as the Halliwell manuscript because I think Halliwell found the darn thing. 1390, it's said to be written. Or it was copied. There's also a sense that, before print was widespread and accessible, scribes were taking one script, one piece of note and writing it out in script. And it's written in Middle English, and it's said to be based on the instructions for a parish priest or eubanitist, a book of instruction on deportment and hygiene. You know, so where did the idea for this manuscript, the Regina's poem, come about? Well, they had this, you know, for the parish priest. This is how you act. This is how you look, you know. And I'm hoping it said to everybody, shine your shoes, my goodness. 1400 AD, the inventory of the Mason's Lodge of York Minster contains two tracing boards. 1400 AD. That's going back. That's before my time. I know some of you listening in will remember when those tracing boards were made. Probably you were sanding them down. I'll defer to your expertise. 1425, the Cook manuscript was written, and it's the second oldest of the extant ancient manuscripts of Freemasonry. And Canterbury Cathedral records show that the Masons of the Lodge was mentioned in the records, and that was 1429. And in 1430, an ordinance was enacted confirming the ancient form and custom of taking apprentices. So you can see that we had a bit of, you know, labor was being organized. The class structure was much, much different than it is today. So was the availability of protections of rights. In 1471, Robert Stowell is appointed the Master of Masons at Westminster Abbey. And the term Master Mason appears after the name of William Orchard at Magdalen College in Oxford in 1479. The word Freemason appeared for the first time in the Statutes of England in 1487. In 1581, oh, here we are, 1539, Francis I of France attempts to stamp out all craft guilds. But craft guilds were able to generate revenues. You know, they had duties and fees. And the king thought that this should be the privilege of the monarch. 1581, the Masons Company is incorporated in Newcastle. And by the way, nice work, Newcastle, yesterday on the football field. And it was given certain powers and duties. And now, in 1583, their manuscript was put together called the Grand Lodge Number 1. It's in the possession of the United Grand Lodge of England. Excuse me. And it's the third oldest of the existing manuscripts relating to Freemasonry. And these are collectively known under various names, the Gothic Constitution, the Ancient Charges, the York Constitutions, or the Old Charges. And there's over 110 of them. Rather than repeat each one on this page, there's a separate listing of old charges. Dig out your Book of Constitution, and you fellows, in Section 6, and you fellows will be able to, at least here in this jurisdiction, will be able to flip through them. William Scaw, who became the Master of the Works in Scotland in 1584, promulgated two sets of rules in 1598. The first in 1598, regulating the Masons of Scotland, and the second in 1599, giving the Lodge of Kilwinning, number 0, the Grand Lodge of Scotland, supervisory powers over the lodges of West Scotland. And it also uses the term in that, the Fellow of the Craft. Now remember, Kilwinning was already issuing conferring charter to other lodges before Grand Lodge came along. So when the Grand Lodge came along, this was okay, you're going to be conferring charter and you're going to be establishing your authority. You could imagine that the fellows of Kilwinning would said, well, okay, we've been doing it for a while. Catch up. We don't have any problem with you. You know, the neighborhood's quite big. You go ahead and do it. But as you can imagine, from our perspective, today we would think, well, the Grand Lodge has to be predominant. Well, no. In that day, we think about the moral high ground, the authority. It wasn't just because a group of people had a meeting and said, this is what we're going to do. You know, we're going to be magnificent one day. Nobody was talking like that. Somebody was trying to establish a contractual authority when the authority already existed, in a sense. If you think back, this is 1598. So Kilwinning was already issuing, forming lodges in different parts of Scotland. Now, I think Kilwinning is around Glasgow, if I'm not mistaken. You can correct me. Your listeners can certainly correct me, and I know you will. So now we're getting into the quite contemporary era, 1600. The first record is made of the admission of a non-operative mason in a lodge in Scotland. His name, John Boswell, the Laird of Auchinleck, becomes a member of the Lodge Edinburgh. The York manuscript number 1, commonly called the York Rolls, now in the possession of the York Lodge number 236, contains the word Freemason. So we begin to see that little bit of crossover. Now, of course, I'm just finishing up a book on the Magus, and that's of course Elias Ashmole. 1617, he was born in Lichfield in England. He was a historian. He married well, and when he married the second time, he married into money, and he became immediately became a philanthropist, which you think is, instead of counting his money and buying the bigger car and the conspicuous display of wealth that's so prevalent in these days. He really cultivated his money. He was a member of the Royal Society, although it is said that he wasn't an active participant in it. But one of the things that we know today is that we have the benefit of the Ashmolean Museum. And that was started, of course, by the bequest at his death by Elias Ashmole. 1617. Now, I'll illustrate this a little more later, but 1619, the account book of the London Masons Company uses the term exception as a description of some members. And in 1621, the records of the Worshipful Company of Freemasons of London indicates that there were accepted and operative Masons. 1621. Now, John Stowe wrote out the Survey of London and mentions the Company of Freemasons, otherwise being termed Freemasons, the Company of Masons also. So the terms were being used interchangeably by 1633. In 1634, Lord Alexander, Sir Anthony Alexander, and Sir Alexander Strand were all made Masons at the Lodge of Edinburgh. So again, you think about it, these little scraps and notations are what we have of was there a great secrecy before that, where there was just this darkness and nothing was written? So we're going to have to look for scribbles on the walls of the caves to tell us what was going on. I don't think so. I think these little snippets and scraps, the little notations that we have, are really talking to us from a time, voices coming from a time when the idea of fraternal orders was starting to move ahead, where we were going into something social rather than something occupational. We, men, society. In 1642, the minutes of Kilwinning Lodge go back. Imagine 1642, and you want to know when the earliest recorded initiation is? Of course you do. This was by Sir Robert Moray, and he is initiated by a group of Masons in a Scottish regiment at Newcastle-on-Tyne on the 20th of May, 1641. That's the earliest recorded initiation. Now you think that's in the records of a lodge. And before that, we had Elias Ashmole, and we often hear about him, writes in his diary. That was 1646. So just to, there's your little stocking stuffer. 1641, Sir Robert Morley was initiated, and there was a record. 1646, 5 years later, do I have that right? Elias Ashmole writes in his diary that he was made a Freemason on the 16th of October. So there's that five-year gap. Don't get your pantyhose in the knot out there, boys. Our antiquarians and historians are digging deep and dusting off a lot of things, and we're adding to the amount of knowledge that we have, the amount of fact. And it's going to change, as it always has. It's going to change our understanding of our past. So this has never been any different than at any point through the history of mankind. So we're seeing that five-year gap. There you go. Remember, Sir Robert Moray, 1641. Well, of course, 1646. You must be talking about Elias Ashmole, that Johnny Come Lately, of course. 20th of May, so there you have it. 1655, the Company of Freemasons in the City of London changed its name to the Company of Masons. Now, there must have been some strict reason behind all that story. Now, we're going to talk today, of course, the theme here is 1666, the Royal Society is founded in London with many Freemasons among its members. This was the alchemists, the scientists, the observers, the people that were pulling together fact, that were looking at the, you know, that slow boil, simmer that started in the Renaissance, went on, where we were, you know, replacing conjecture, and all conjecture was saying, look, this is the best explanation we have for the facts at the time. So we look up at the stars and we don't have ways of measuring things. So we say, well, we must be at the center. Okay, that theory. But it's based on, you know, observation, but it's not based on fact. So when observation, we extrapolate, we take the observations and then we guess. We take a calculated guess. And we say it's the best guess to explain what's going on until we can prove it. So again, science, we're seeing the advancement of science going on. This isn't, Freemasonry didn't lead everything, like my goodness. But it was influenced. It was part and parcel. The evolution, our history, allows us to trace the evolution of the craft with social and scientific and artistic evolution. So there are parallels, and you can see influences, which, of course, there would be. Freemasons were amongst the groups of the Royal Society. And I think a careful read of that period of time lets us think that, you know, being able to have some privileged a private conversation about outlandish, of course, scientists would use that. So you're not going to get arrested for saying something heretical. Say what's on your mind and also say your proof. So these were the radicals in a way, the cutting edge, and cutting edge and change always comes from this sort of unpleasant radical kind of an element. Well, they don't, you know, their hair is too long. They speak a funny language. Their skin is a different color. Their ideas are weird. We can't accept that. Well, those are the areas where, you know, newness always comes in that kind of sort of turmoil. You know, the currents are swirling around. Now, here's a part that's kind of interesting if you've been. 1668, the Hall of the Worshipful Company of Masons in London is rebuilt. It is believed that a speculative lodge met in this building. And in 1670, the records of Lodge Aberdeen begin. You know, who's going to do it? You take down the notes. No, I don't want it. Why should we take down notes? We were there. We all know what went on. You can hear that back and forth, can't you? And they show that some Masons were speculative and others were operative. And, you know, so it's like, well, who's going to do it? Well, the speculative, they don't do anything, so let them do it. Well, hell, if you think it's such a good idea, why don't you do it yourself, you operative lot? So I don't think there was that separation. Now, 1680, Sir Dr. James Anderson is born in Aberdeen. Well, now, that's kind of a significant little event, isn't it? Dr. He was a member of the clergy and the son of a clergyman. 1682, Elias Ashmole writes in his diary that he attended a lodge meeting at Mason's Hall in London. So he wants us, you know, he's a diarist, he's going to keep us up to date. 1683, Jean de Sellier, that's 3 years younger than Anderson. He was born in Rochelle, France, a Huguenot family. And, of course, when the king, is it Charles, I think, expunged the Huguenot Protestant group from France, you know, stick around, you've got this much time, if you're not gone, the sheriff is going to execute you, your family, your children. So there was an exodus. France had done this earlier. This wasn't something that was like, you know, this is sad, sad part of history. But they had done this with Jewish people earlier, all Jews out. You figure it out. You figure it out. Of course, there are reasons and thinking at the time. Imperialism was unchallenged, and anyway, we see the product of what we have today as a result of some of the influences in the past. 1686, Dr. Robert Plott published The Natural History of Staffordshire, in which he ridiculed the Society of Freemasons. And this gives some proof that a symbolic lodge was in existence at the time. All right? Of course it would be. 1688, the Lodge of Accepted Masons met at Trinity College in Dublin, and Randall Holme III, a Chester genealogist and antiquarian, described an association with members of the society called Freemasons. The Society of Freemasons is established, mentioned in a satirical speech in July at the commencement of exercises at the University of Dublin. So we're getting through the 17th century. An anti-Masonic leaflet was published warning people against the freed Masons. That was in 1698, anti-Masonic. And in 1702, the Halfoot Lodge minute book commences. Now remember, we're skimming through a period where, you know, the London Society, the Royal Society, is formed just between fires, 1666, the big fire. This is after the beheading of the king in the early part of the 17th century, two civil wars, and the reestablishment of Charles II on the throne. So it all jammed into this part of history. And we're looking just at that beautiful part of, you know, dimensionally of the craft. But they were very major and significant events. And oh, by the way, and the plague, that had not been a sponge in the 17th century. Yes, so huge, huge social things going on. Now, work today, think today around you in the last 30, 40, 50, 100 years. What are the significant events that have shaped the world that we live in today? I would not just want to say world wars. I'm sorry, but I hope that there is more to our development than that sorry state of homicidal conflict. I just think that, I hope not. But there you have it. They were significant. And are to this day influential. We can now look at the rise and fall of certain empires. Why did you know the Middle East go from being an articulate source of science to an area without a voice anymore? Today, the research is just not happening. Now, scratch our heads and say, well, what in the world went on? This, you know, what? This is just unbelievable. And it isn't just, and again, is our development all about money? I hope not. I hope history is a little kinder to us than that. In 1709, Sir Richard Steele published an article in the Tatler, and that's a famous paper of the day. There's a sort of a washed-out version of that going around magazine today, discussing certain people. I'm sorry, the people that love it. I take that back. I'll burn for saying what was washed out. It was discussing certain people in which he says they have their signs and tokens like Freemasons. They have some secret intimations of each like Freemasons. A little tattletale. 1710, the Honorable Elizabeth St. Leger, the famous Lady Mason, who was supposed to have eavesdropped at a Masonic initiation, is given 2 degrees. She later marries Richard Ellsworth and is also known under that name. So that story about the Lady Mason, there you have it, 1710. Did anybody get hysterical? Sounds like a common sense prevailed. We don't have a woman in here. We'll just make her a Mason. Works for me. Can you imagine the the chattering and the nervousness that would go around the lodge today. I kind of have a giggle. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Let's call an authority to help us make up our mind about what to do. We've become children instead of just reasoning it through by comparison. Of course, we'd manage it well today. And of course, today it's altogether different. We're getting all, oh my goodness, what would happen? Well, we have today, we have Masons bragging about their wives helping them with ritual. I don't know. So much for your own thing. Anyway, beloved, I like family. 1716. We see a meeting held at the Apple Tree Tavern in Charles Street in Covent Garden to discuss revival of the quarterly communications and an annual assembly. Did you get that? A revival. Does anybody have a little bit of something from about a little more than a 12-year-old, you know, sitting close? Just send it over. Put it in a cab. That's the year 1716, of course. And remember, at the time, if you look, that was advertised in the local paper, and the results were advertised. It was put printed in the paper. You know, this is what happened. These who showed up. It wasn't like there was a great clamor. Oh, pick me! I want to be there first, like there is today. You know, all of that kind of stuff. It was like, what the hell? You know, why should I do that? And so one lodge of the four said, you know, this is a good idea. Get out there. But it was somewhere either between 7 and 12 of their members showed up. And they went and knocked, come on, you know, send over a couple of fellows. You know, we're going over here and we're going to the Apple Tavern. We'll talk about this. It'll be good. We'll at least have a pint. And these lodges had to be coaxed. So how many did they send? One, two, three fellows. That's the start. And it wasn't like, oh, gee, one is dominant. It was like, if you're dominant, you're going nowhere. You need a team. You need to have some buy-in from the other lodges in the area. So it was small. But then I think, you know, that fits exactly well with how we function today. Doing things at a big scale obviously doesn't work. So these fellas came along with what I think is a reasonable idea, good idea. And it knocked on the door of all the lodges and said, right, we're going to have a meeting. We're going to watch out there. And these lodges said, the hell, you know, we've got the other things to do. We're busy with our own business there. So instead of, you know, pouting and saying, oh, gee, we failed. And it's, you know, let's get the phone committees out to try and guilt these guys into it. Like, geez, you know, give it up. It's like, oh, gee, I forgot. dear, you've never dated somebody you never went out with somebody you didn't want to see. Oh, gee, it slipped my mind. Oh, so we have a capacity to work with, you know, if there's a convincing idea that works for a small group of people, then you protect it and you nurture it. And if it has any legs to it, other people will figure that out. You know, it's not like advertising. We've got this new product, and now we have to go advertise it, and it's brilliant, and it's better than everybody else's product, so jump in. Or, you know, you must do this. Yeah, well, fine. I'm not buying the new fryer this Christmas because somebody is telling me it's brilliant. All of that stuff just becomes background noise, and it's blown off. So at the time, think about it. We're functioning and we're meeting and we've had our charter and we're doing fine Masonically, and somebody says, well, go down to the City of London. Well, all right, man, I've got to put on a suit. I have to travel down there. There's thieves and muggers running around, you know. All right, fine, we can do that. It's no big deal. We're used to it. But that overwhelming, here we have something great. No, it was subtle, which tells me, and I think tells us, that it had some depth behind it. This was a good idea. 1717, the first Grand Lodge is formed on the 24th of June. Happens to be St. John the Baptist Day in London by four lodges meeting at the City of Westminster. There you go. Now, here's the interesting fellow that I think, I didn't discover him, of course, 1719, the Reverend Brother, and I think Doctor too, John Theophilus de Saulier, is elected Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England. Here's the second one. What was the first one? Mackay? Was that the first? Held it for 1 year. Didn't have one in the first year, of course. And he was elected. Now, that fellow, that little rascal, de Saulier, the expat Huguenot, was a very, very bright man, involved in the development of the Constitution. Also developed somehow, after this, traveled up to Scotland, and about a year later, lo and behold, the Grand Lodge of Scotland took root. Now, what would this discussion have been over that dinner table, I wonder? 1721, John, Duke of Montague, is elected the Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of England. And this election bought much publicity and prestige, to the craft. Good idea. So it would be like, if we were starting today, what's this like? We're going to have Justin Timberlake, I guess, is going to be, and then Bieber. Some of these rock stars are going to join. We get free publicity, and it's like, oh my, if he joined, and he has 8,000 followers on Twitter, or 8 million followers on Twitter, maybe I should join. On the 24th of June, the Grand Lodge of England adopts a regulation that all regular lodges are required to secure a charter from the Grand Lodge. That's the 24th of June, 1721. So remember, you see a little bit of a gap, hey? Again, around the June date, the symbolism certainly there, St. John the Baptist Day. But it's 1723, and, you know, these Grand Masters set the task to Anderson and de Saulier to develop the first edition of the Constitutions. And that was 1723 that came out. 1724, the Gormagons, an anti-Masonic group, made its first appearance. And the Committee of Charity was formed by the Grand Lodge of England. Now, in 1725, Grand Lodge of Ireland is formed. First traveling military lodges formed in 1732 out of the Grand Lodge of Ireland. Influential back in those discussions of the ancients and moderns. Freemasonry appears in Italy, and persecutions follow in the city of Florence, 1733. Now, in 1734, the Grand Lodge of Scotland is formed. And, of course, how would you rein in the lodges that were already chartering other lodges? Well, you know, how would you organize that? Like herding cats? It's like, how do you gain consensus? Well, first you sit down and you have a respectful conversation, and you conduct yourself with some dignity and move forward. A warrant is issued in 1737 by Lord Derwentwater for the formation of the Lodge of Sweden. And on the 6th of September, the first lodge meets in 1737. It met in Germany. Now, 1738, Dr. Anderson, published the second edition of the Constitutions of the Freemasons. Remember, he came out with his first set, 1723, and he said, no, you know, it's far too Protestant. It's not going to work. Now, remember, back and forth, the country had gone from Protestant to, within 16 years, Protestant to Catholic to Protestant Catholic, and everybody said, right now, you know, what's the king or what's the queen saying? What are they? That's what I am. Trivializing faith and belief, you know, trivializing. So here we come along and say, the first constitution, well, of course, you could imagine, written by Protestant clergy, had a Protestant influence. They said, no, take the, you know, come on. Tone that down so that that's not what's important. That is not what's significant. And I have heard some wags out there talking about how this is Christian organization. Really? Really? I guess if anybody defines the order, it's the thinking of any single Freemason. We have, somewhere between 3 and 5 million of us, so we can all just say whatever we think it is. not against the background of the principles, the obligations, and fact. It is secular. Religion doesn't matter. Faith, on the other hand, is another issue. And then we can get all offensive and aggressive about that too, which again is completely un-Masonic, embarrassing and bad manners. Okay, so we secure from the Pope in January 17, 1749. Joseph Turumbia, a Roman Catholic priest living in Spain, secures permission from the Pope to become a Freemason so as to find out who and what are Freemasons. As a result of his joining the order, he compiled a list of who belonged to the order. Oh, there's a clever boy. Oh, what kind of mischief would go on with that? Doesn't this fit with Taxil, Leo Taxil, that contrived name, that nom de plume, who wanted to blacken the eye of the Catholic Church? So here, listen to this. 1751, 2 years later, in March, Turumbia gives a list of 97 lodges to the Grand Inquisition. Now, you know the Inquisition came out of Spain, from Grenada predominantly, which caused the arrest and punishment of members by the Inquisition. There's a good boy. There's a good boy. Pope Benedict XIV issued his papal bull, Providas, on the 18th of May against the craft. And on the July 2nd, King Ferdinand VI suppresses the order in Spain. There you go. The ancient Grand Lodge of England is formed on the 17th of July, 1751. The ancient Grand Lodge of England. This was formerly called a schism of the 1717 Grand Lodge of England. Got it? So it went from Grand Lodge of England to the ancient Grand Lodge of England in 1751. It is formed by a group of Masons opposed to the proposed changes to the landmarks. The Grand Lodge of England becomes known as the Moderns. And getting better? It gets better. In 1752, Lawrence Dumont becomes secretary of the ancient Grand Lodge of England. And lots written about him. I'd like to say that it's all scandalous, but it isn't. He's a real boy. And a bright fellow. 1754, the first known use of the term sublime degree of a Master Mason in a certificate drawn by the Grand Lodge of Ireland. There you go. And think about the Lodge of Promulgation that's to come. Grand Lodge of Ireland was significant, wasn't it? Alexander Slade published the Freemasons Examined, which is an exposé and claims the craft's ritual is based on the Tower of Babel. And 6 editions are published in 5 years. There. So we have a little bit. The Ahiman Raison, the Constitution of the Ancients, was published by Lawrence Dumont in 1756. Now, strict union was reached between the Grand Lodge of Ireland and the Ancients in 1758. And 1767, the first lodge is established in China by the Grand Lodge of England. Now, I think they must mean ancient Grand Lodge of England. William Preston published the Illustrations of Freemasonry, which goes to 17 editions. Now, the strict union between the Grand Lodge of Scotland and the Moderns was reached in 1773. The boys were having serious conversation, really. Is this issue significant enough for us to remain apart? Or, you know, they were looking for consolidation of ideas. And they found it. They found reason to find. I don't think we're talking about compromise. I think we're talking about like-mindedness. Now, William Hutchinson, here we come into the whole question again of secularism. 1775, published the book called A Spirit of Freemasonry. And it's on Masonic philosophy, expressing the view that the craft is a Christian or association. Now, 1776, the Masonic Hall is dedicated to the Great Queen Street, London. Really interesting building inside a building, as you know. The Royal Masonic Institution for Girls was established in England in 1788. First Masonic Journal in England, the Sentimental and Masonic Magazine, 1792. Lots of things happening in the 18th century. Irish Masonic Female Orphan School is founded. Good bunch of boys. 1809, the Lodge of Promulgation is formed in England and lasts for 2 years to report on the differences between the ritual of the moderns and ancients. And the schism has now been in existence for 58 years. It's like, you know, we could live, you could live, go about your business. 1813, the ancients and moderns become, 1813, become reconciled and form the United Grand Lodge of Ancient, Free, and Accepted Masons of England, 27th December, St. John's Day, United Grand Lodge of England. Where, there you have it, don't you? So that's just, and then, you know, it's 1816, the Grand Royal Arch Chapter of Scotland is formed. The Union of Royal Arch Chapters in England occurs in 1817. All kinds of interesting stuff. James Halliwell discovers the Regius manuscript in the British Museum. That's in 1839. I'm thinking it was like, you know, it wasn't that long ago. But, and then it gets into some papal stuff. They had nothing better to do than to sort of say unpleasant things about some of our ancient brethren and see conspiracy where wherever the you can. You know, it's in the eye of the beholder, I often say. If you want to have a conspiracy, go right ahead. We're a hard bunch to pull together. It's like, you know, okay, well, we'll conspire against that. But, you know, right now we're just going to sit down and have a nice meal together and a few drinks and relax. We'll get around to that conspiracy stuff. No, we're not blowing you off. No, last theory. So work out, there's some things you can work into your conversation. And, you know, as you're sitting there with your martini, your two olive martini, you can say, well, no, just remember this. Is, you know, this, there's 5 years between that Elias Ashmole and, you know, the first record. So it's awful when you replace the supposition with fact, doesn't it? And Freemasons, you know, we have fact, and then 75 years later, we find all kinds of new information that really reforms that fact. And so our facts are constantly evolving. Isn't everything? Aren't you? Aren't I? So today, we say, well, and I woke up the other day thinking, how long are we, you know, we have King James Version of the Bible. Well, that was a version. That wasn't the, it's a version of. And that's been rewritten, updated, upgraded, you know. Somebody's kicked the tires and said, hey, we can do, we can approve that. And that for those that part of it is inconsistent. Here's the real facts of what happened. What we're finding even with, you know, it's not like, oh, it's all mythology, it's all magical. No, the facts are really, really quite important. And there's it for thinking people. If we're literalists, I apologize to the literalists. They're absolutely right in the way that they see things. A brick is a brick is a brick. Or a cigar is a cigar is a cigar. Now, I want to talk to you. Remember last week, we were talking about how to live better. And Montaigne, this is a portion where he said, you know, live better, you have to use little tricks. Back in the day, people thought that if you lived if you adapted one of the Hellenistic ways of philosophies, you could really live a good life. But this requires a bit of a belief that's supposition. It's not real fact-based. So today we live in a philosophical period of positivism. Now, will the philosophers out there listening, please correct me. Because I even think that that's, I don't know if it's outdated, but that notion has evolved. But positivism is really saying, well, we have to have some facts. You know, we have to, if whatever you're saying philosophically, there has to be some fact to support that. Because we're not dreamers. We're not just, you know, casting our eyes, you know, around saying, well, that seems like a nice idea. You need to be able to support it with some fact. So, this takes us back to a time where I think we can pluck some low-hanging fruit from these notions of the Hellenistic philosophies. Stoic, Epicurean, and particularly. Hmm? And they spent much time devising techniques and thought experiments. And, of course, that's the way that Einstein was able to formulate his ideas for the relativity of time. You know, putting a clock on a train, remember that? And does time change if you're moving or standing still? Well, yeah, it is. And that was tested back in, what, the 70s? Well, putting a very exacting timepiece on a plane, leaving one, and suddenly, God, there was a difference. You fly around the Earth, and what happens to time? Time moves faster when you're standing still. Accordingly, Stoic and Epicurean thinkers spent much time devising techniques and thought experiments. For example, imagine that today is the last day of your life. Are you ready to face death? Maybe after I get a coffee, but anyway, imagine even that this very moment now is the last moment of your existence. Now, this is a mindset that's supposed to give us some answers and balance. What are you feeling? Do you have regrets? Are there things you wish you had done differently? Are you really alive at this instance, or are you consumed with panic, denial, and remorse? That's, you know, if you add up those days, that's what we call a life. This experiment opens your eyes to what is important to you, what's really important. You want to walk around thinking about carrying, and they're saying to us, you carry the burden, but it's unproductive. And if you do that your entire life, you're carrying unproductive burdens every single day, where are you going with that? Doing that doesn't make them go away. The demons are always there. So these fellows are saying, really, think about it. If it was the last day of your life, is that the most important thing in your mind? Oh, people don't like me, or, oh, gee, I've got a secret I have to hide. What secret? Mostly, you know, a significant number of people on the Fortune 500 bonus list are people with dyslexia, with learning complications. So if you want to say, oh, gee, I have this learning complication and I can't succeed, well, really? Go and join that crowd. You know, go over and stand with all the successful lions of business, men and women over there that have prevailed. And, yeah, they work harder. No, they're not whining. And, yeah, they'll send their jet for you. Go over and talk with them first and then come back. Accordingly, Stoic and Epicurean thinkers spend much time thinking about these thought experiments. Are there things you wish you had done differently? So are you really alive at this instant? Is it, you know, you're always thinking about yesterday? I've done scandalous things. And, you know, I'm caught up in turmoil. There's no confidence. I'm bitter. I'm anxious around people, so I have to be angry or a little bit off-putting and unpleasant. Really? Some Stoics even acted out these last-moment experiments with props and a supporting cast. Seneca wrote of a wealthy man called Pacuvius. You know, you and I will love Pacuvius, who conducted a full-scale funeral ceremony for himself every day, ending with a feast after which he would have himself carried from the table to his bed on a bier while all the guests and service intoned, he has lived his life, he has lived his life. You could achieve the same effect more simply and cheaply just by holding the idea of your own demise in your mind and paying full attention to it. The Epicurean writer Lucretius suggests picturing yourself at the point of death and considering two possibilities. Enter that you have lived well, in which case you can go your way satisfied, like a well-fed guest leaving a party. Or you have not, and then it makes no difference that you are losing your life, since you obviously did not know what to do with it anyway. Oh, ouch. Lucretius, a little too much honesty in the morning there, buddy. Let's sit down and have a talk about that. Let's distract ourselves by whining and complaining. This may seem scant comfort on your deathbed, but if you think about it in the midst of life, it helps you to change your perspective. Now, does this fit into your conversation, probably, if you're finding this just tedious, just tune this part out. This is not, don't listen to this part. I need a disclaimer here. This is for people that are wondering about that whole business of self-development and improvement, good man, better, that kind of thing, that are taking it a little more seriously than the Whopper Singer. This may be scant comfort to you on your deathbed, but changing your perspective, probably not a bad idea. And, you know, again, just the last couple of days, I've been noticing these things in people, people that have just this incredibly healthy outlook, wonderful. And they go about their business, they go about their life, they're just the most pleasant people to be around. Such shifts in attitude, and they happen to be Masons, but it's not exclusive to Masonry. Such shifts in attitude are the purpose of many of the thought experiments. If you have lost somebody or something precious, you can try to value them differently by imagining that you never knew that person or never owned that object. How can you miss what you never had? A different angle produces a different emotion. Plutarch suggested such a ploy in a letter to his wife after their 2-year-old daughter died. He advised her to think back to before the girl was born and pretend that they were back in those days again. Whether this consoled her is not known. Man trying to offer some support to his grieving wife. Nice man. Whether this consoled her is not known, but at least it gave her something to focus on instead of swimming in an ocean of undifferentiated grief. Oh, that sounds awful. Montaigne and La Boetie both knew this letter well. They were buddies, eh? For La Boetie translated it into French, and Montaigne edited his translation for publication. It may have come into Montaigne's mind each time one of his own children died, as well as when he lost La Boetie, his best friend. The friendship had been so short that it should not have been difficult to remember a time before it and recapture his pre-La Boetie nonchalance. Such tricks of the imagination can be used in mundane situations as well as extreme ones. They are effective even against mild feelings of boredom or depression. If you feel tired of everything you possess, Celeste suggests Plutarch, pretend that you have lost all these things and are missing them desperately. Whether the object of a favorite plate, a friend, a mistress, or the good fortune of living in a time of peace and in good health, this exercise magically makes it seem worth having after all. The principle is the same as when brooding on death. Faced with the idea of losing something now, you realize its value. The key is to cultivate mindfulness, or prosoche, P-R-O-S-O-C-H-E, prosoche, another key Greek term. Mindful attention to the trick that underlies many of the other tricks. It is a call to attend to the inner world, and thus also to the outer world, for our uncontrolled emotion blurs reality as tears blur a view. Anyone who clears their vision and lives in a full awareness of the world as it is, Seneca says, can never be bored with life. A person who does not sleepwalk through the world, moreover, is free to respond to situations in the right way, without hesitation, and as if there were questions asked all of a sudden, as Epictetus puts it, a violent attack, a quarrel, the loss of a friend. All these are demands barked at you by life, as by a school teacher trying to catch you not paying attention to class. Even a moment of boredom is such a question. Whatever happens, however unforeseen it is, you should be able to respond in a precisely suitable way. That is why, for Montaigne, and hopefully for us, learning to live appropriately, or apropos, is the great and glorious masterpiece of human life. Stoics and Epicureans alike approach this goal mainly through rehearsal and meditation. These are the thoughtful introverts. Like tennis players practicing volleys and smashes for hours, they used rehearsal to carve grooves of habit down which their minds would run as naturally as water down a riverbed. It is a form of self-hypnosis. The great Stoic Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius kept notebooks in which he would go over the changes of perspective he wished to drill into himself. How good it is when you have roast meat and such like foods before you to impress in your mind that this is the dead body of a fish, this the dead body of a bird or pig, and again, that the Falernian wine is the mere juice of grapes, and that your purple-edged robe simply the hair of a sheep soaked in shellfish blood, and in sexual intercourse that it is no more than the friction of a membrane and a spurt of mucus ejected. At other times he imagined flying up to the heavens so that he could gaze down and see how insignificant all human concerns were from such a distance. Seneca did this too. Place before your mind's eye the vast spread of time's abyss, and consider the universe, and then contrast our own so-called human life with infinity. Saying, make it small, Make it small. Well, I want to leave it that. That's enough. You can only take so much self-improvement in a day, in a week. Let's move on. We'll come back to this. Let's pick it up. Little bits. It's not like you want to gorge at this table. You want to have little bits, different tastes of a lot of different things. Now, I talked a little bit last week about about the tracing boards, didn't I? So I want to talk a little bit more about that in the context. But I'm moving on into historical origins. So bear with me that I'm going to talk just a little bit about Solomon, just a little bit about the temple, and Mithraism and Druids and the Essenes and the search for the roots of Freemasonry. Okay, just context. And we'll get into these people, Jachin and Boaz, and what that's about. King Hiram Abiff and Hiram, King of Tyre. Interesting cat. So just to frame it, the biblical figure of King Solomon has always been said to have possessed great wisdom, and for Freemasons, he represents an archetypal leader or grand master who inspires reverence and offers an ideal role model. Now, when I think about I try not to think too much. But Freemasonry is a thinking man's preoccupation. So we don't have to make any excuses for that, do we? Certainly not. We're going to have he does. You know, when we talk about him, he's talking about great wisdom and learning, and there's a sedateness about the man. He was the son of King David and Bathsheba. His mother assisted Solomon in becoming king after the death of his father, and this is in 961 BC. However, it is the story of the building of the first of the Jewish temple named after him that holds the greatest relevance for Freemasons. The temple built by King Solomon is central to the iconography and traditions of modern Freemasonry. It is described in the Bible as being the first temple to be built by the Jewish people in Jerusalem. Now remember the tabernacles that we hear about. Well, tabernacle really is tent. Things that could be, they had a portability, big, framed, but tent. Think of the girds. Think of those big structures, the heavy thing. But it was quite livable. It is described in the Bible as being the first temple to be built. David originally proposed the building of the temple, and during his lifetime, he made preparations for its creation. As well as gathering workers for the project, he drew up plans for its structure. It was intended to house the legendary Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was made from acacia wood and gold and held a pair of stone tablets inscribed with the Ten Commandments that Moses had been given by God. It also contained the rod of Aaron and a jar of manna. The lid of the Ark of the Covenant was called the Mercy Seat. In 1 Chronicles 22, King David tells Solomon that he must build a temple for the God of Israel, and that he has provided him with 100,000 talents of gold, 1 million talents of silver, and so much iron and bronze that it cannot be weighed. He also outlines how he has provided stone and timber for the building, as well as masons, stone cutters, and carpenters. In 1 Chronicles 28, King David gives Solomon not only instructions on the form that the temple should take, but detailed information about items that should be used within the building, such as lampstands, bowls, and cups, and the weight that they should be, depending on the material used, such as gold and silver. King David reveals to his people that God had spoken to him and said that he could not build the temple himself because he had been a warrior who had spilt blood. Instead, God told him that he had chosen Solomon to build a temple and that he would establish his kingdom forever if Solomon followed his commandments and kept the covenant that had been agreed with God. The temple was to be built in Mount Moriah in Jerusalem, where Abraham had offered his own son Isaac as a willing sacrifice to God. Solomon decided to build a temple for the name of the Lord and a royal palace for himself. He conscripted 70,000 laborers and 80,000 stonecutters in the hill country, with 3,600 to oversee them. Solomon sent word to King Hiram of Tyre, "Once they dealt with my father David and sent him cedar to build himself a house to live in, I am now about to build a house for the name of the Lord my God and dedicate it to him for offering fragrant incense before him and for the regular offering of the rose of bread and the burnt offerings morning and evening on the Sabbaths and the new moons and the appointed festivals of the Lord our God, as ordained forever for Israel. The house that I am to build will be great, for our God is greater than other gods." Always the clamor, eh? "So now send me an artisan skilled to work in gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and in purple, crimson, and blue fabrics, trained also in engraving, to join the skilled workers who are with me in Judah and Jerusalem, whom my father David provided." The unlawful murder of Hiram Abiff, architect and builder of the Temple of Solomon, is a dramatic story that is central to Masonic ritual. The building of the Temple of Solomon, as recorded in the Bible, actually mentions two individuals named Hiram. The first is Hiram, king of Tyre, while the second is a certain Hiram Abi, who is described as a gifted master craftsman. It seems most likely that this is the Hiram described in Masonic lore. Hiram, king of Tyre, informs King Solomon that, "I have dispatched Hiram Abi, a skilled artisan endowed with understanding, the son of one of the Danite women, his father a Tyrian. He is trained to work in gold, silver, bronze, iron, stone, and wood, and in purple, blue, and crimson fabrics and fine linen, and to do all sorts of engraving and execute any design that may be assigned to him with your artisans, the artisans of my lord, your father David. We will cut whatever timber you need from Lebanon and bring it to you as rafts by sea to Joppa. You will take it up to Jerusalem." In Freemasonry, Hiram Abiff is also described as the widow's son based on the following passage from the Bible. "Now King Solomon invited and received Hiram of Tyre. He was the son of a widow of the tribe of Naphtali, whose father, a man of Tyre, had been an artisan in bronze. He was full of skill, intelligence and knowledge in working bronze. He came to King Solomon and did all his work." So Hiram, king of Tyre, he was the son of a widow. So Hiram Abiff is often described as being the widow's son. So we have a composite, Hiram Abiff being a composite person. Work is said to have commenced on building the temple in the fourth year of King Solomon's reign on the second day of the second month. This puts the date around 957 BC. The Bible itself does not provide very much more information about Hiram, the master craftsman, and the story of his unlawful killing by the trio that comprised Jubala, Jubolo, and Jubalam. As the temple was nearing completion, belongs only into Masonic ritual and to legend. King Solomon paid for the assistance of King Hiram with a fortune of tithe. In return for the manpower, the skilled artisans, the provision of cedar and cypress wood, and the other materials used in the building of the temple, King Solomon provided food for the household of King Hiram. According to the Bible, he gave him a yearly supply of 20,000 cores of wheat and 20 cores of fine oil. During the building of the temple, Hiram produced furniture and adornments made from precious metals, including an important pair of pillars that were set at the entrance of the temple. We'll come back to that, can we? Now, let's get to the sort of the primary part of the program today. This was a show on Royal Society of Freemasonry. And as I, you don't mind me being, just get framing this a little bit, setting this up for us all, we'll come back to what those pillars were about. I hope that was useful. It was kind of interesting. A little part of information that filled in a question in my mind. The Royal Society stands as a benchmark for a change that defined the way we validate science to this very day. I'm being magnanimous. I'm being generous with the Royal Society, I think, but maybe not so much. Science was a closed male-only shop at that time. The experimental model had gained traction with the work of Francis Bacon. His work lacked the ethical framework expected in the 21st century, of course. Like the torture of animals and humans was accepted as was an accepted means to get results. Like if you flay something alive, what happens? What occurs? What sensations? How much before the creature dies? These were questions that they were answering because they didn't have the you know, sort of an ethical standard that we do today. But he was part of a movement that showed how experimentation and repeated trials were necessary to validate results. They were gentlemen, middle class, with sufficient wealth that produced an escape from daily effort to survive. We know it as leisure. If a gentleman said that he had found a result, he wasn't challenged. His word was his bond. There must have been some informal processes that restricted flaky thinkers. Nevertheless, in the 18th century, people began to expect that methodology and results would be open to all interested parties. So if you did, if I said, yeah, well, the sun is the center of the universe. Well, my word is my bond. You know, so everybody's going to say, right, Dale, you must be right. Well, they said, yeah, you must be right, but we want to see how you arrived at that answer, if you don't mind. And if you can't provide that, then go and have a nap, Dale. So this was the beginning of self-made men. Self-made men does have a bearing on us here in Canada, particularly those third sons that were coming over here to make a name for themselves, to actually make a career for themselves. Through the military. And here was a posting here in North America. Anyway, let's get back to this was the beginning, really. We're looking at the beginning of self-made men here through science. They were unencumbered in financial influences because they paid for their own laboratory and material. So validation of truths by science overshadowed the former power of kings or bishops or superstition. As England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales welcomed the 19th century, speculative Freemasonry began to take a recognizable form. The history of Freemasonry is obscure prior to Grand Lodge. And I'm saying that relative. And, of course, now, you know, we know more and more and more. So I may have to even amend that. I wrote that not too long ago. It's not as obscure as it once was, so I'll put it that way. We can hope that historians will continue to discover more information, but we also have experienced the hidden influence of the men who were the Royal Society. Since 1717, Freemasonry has been an explosion of written work. Much of it in opinion pieces based on fragments of facts. It is vital we continue to read as broadly as possible. This is where an understanding of the context of Freemasonry will liberate the intellectual connection to our roots. We discover our future by discovering our past. Metaphysical, philosophical, spiritual, and fraternal we endure. Oh, goody. Let's talk about the Royal Society of Freemasonry. I think I kind of like that. Did I write that? Son of a gun. All right. I don't know how that happened, but every so often it's a worthwhile idea just plops itself out there. There is a tradition that the philosophers and scientists under the name of Royal Society founded Freemasonry in the 17th century during the reign of Charles II. There is an interesting cat. Charles II stepped up to the people that had beheaded his dad. According to this theory, Dr. John Wilkins, a very learned man, wanted to get rid of Richard Cromwell's administration and to restore the monarchy. He thought of organizing a society or club that, under the pretense of advanced sciences, would in fact allow the king's allies to meet without problem. The meetings always started with a scientific lecture that was followed by political discussion. After the Restoration, this society took the name the Royal Society of Sciences, and some believe that Freemasonry started here. What say you so far? Let's hear a little more. I'm not buying it. Not all historical evidences support this theory. In fact, John Wilkins was quite close to the Cromwells, father and son alike. Son was a little flakier, not exactly the warrior that is the old man was, eh? What'd you say? And, you know, even though dad said, oh, I'm dying, all right, you take the crown. And you know where that went. John Wilkins was close to the Cromwells, and he was an opponent to the monarch. In 1648, he was nominated master of Wadham College, replacing a royalist who had been sacked. In 1649, after the decapitation of Charles I, he joined the Republican Party. In 1656, he married Cromwell's sister, and later Richard Cromwell made him master of Trinity College. But he lost the job when the monarchy was restored 1 year later. His references as a royalist are very poor, to say the least. Moreover, most members of the Royal Society were known anti-monarchists. In addition, he is assumed to have become disenchanted with Richard Cromwell's administration in 1658. But the society was founded in 1646. General Monk is said to have been a member, but his name does not appear anywhere in the archive of the Royal Society. It has been shown that the Royal Society was engaged in scientific matters and that political discussions were forbidden at its meetings. This shows that this theory was certainly invented. Christopher Frederick Nicolai, a German, stated that some scientists who wanted to promote the experimental philosophy that had been introduced by Bacon founded Freemasonry. The Royal Society was founded in parallel to study science in general. Many scientists participated in the foundation of both societies. According to this theory, Bacon owned much of the Rosicrucians' natural philosophy. The Royal Society was created in 1646 by members who agreed with Bacon that philosophy and the physical sciences should be made available to all people. Members of both societies held meetings and made many scientific experiments in common. Time was not, however, ready for this type of thinking. Religion was overshadowed by a mystical quasi-Gnostic theology, and alchemy was widely practiced. I think that sounds like a bad thing. According to another group of learned men, among them Wilkins and Elias Ashmole, created in 1646, a second learned but secret society whose initiated members believed that science should not be divulged to all people. Its object was to build the House of Solomon in a literal sense. These philosophers used allegories to express their ideas. This was a society of alchemists and astrologers that, according to Nicolai, was the origin of Freemasonry. Both societies were created in 1646 with the same aims. They were to be known later as the Royal Society and Freemasonry, the former being an open society dedicated to made science available to all, while the other was of the opinion that this knowledge should be restricted to the few chosen initiates. The Society of Freemasons remained alive after the Restoration of 1660, met regularly, and went as far as adopting internal regulations in 1663. However, the times had changed. The zeal of its members declined, and with its society. The Royal Society, on the other hand, with its open policy, prospered under Charles II, and many Freemasons, including Elias Ashbole, joined it. However, Freemasonry survived and made some changes in its constitution to clarify, in particular, its aims. Among other things, the Temple of Solomon replaced Bacon's House of Solomon as its main allegory. This theory of the origin of the craft is not supported by historical evidences any more than any other theories. Curiouser and curiouser. So where do you go? Enough fact to form your opinion? Where do you go with that? So much for an iPad. Anyway. Let's wrap up the show with a part that you've been waiting for. I know you've been wanting to get into the term exception. Where in the world did that come from, eh? The meaning of exception. In the 18th century, the phrase free and accepted Mason to designate a Freemason was developed and is still in use today. Most readers, this is from the work of Tobias Churton, and he is the authority. He's renowned as an authority on Masonic history, the real deal historian, scholar. Most readers seeing the words will immediately imagine the word accepted means that the person has been accepted within a community. This is the way Masons today like to think of it. I've heard brethren sing heartily of how glad they are to have been accepted as Freemasons. However, an alternate interpretation of the evidence not only makes this supposition less secure, but it also makes sense of one of the great conundra of the exception phenomena itself. How could it have been that the leading professional architects, long since initiated into Freemasons' apprenticeships and deemed therefrom, were prepared to pay good money to join the Fellowship of Freemasons as Ashmole styles the fraternity in 1682? Like, what's the motive? The reason would be that they were going to receive something, or rather, and more specifically, that they were going to have to accept something, that they were going to have to take something in. This acceptance was not simply a form of gain, but of also perhaps even surrendering. Something sacred is being suggested, the need to consecrate, keep separate, keep apart, and to secrete. This secret was not to be a thing simply withheld from others, but something to secrete in oneself. This was, perhaps, not a word, but an experience. The secret is something holy, to be kept apart from the world, secreted in awe. In this context, we must try to keep thinking of secrets as things we cannot tell or want to find, but as something you are not going to, could not utter, even if you wanted to, something literally unspeakable. If this interpretation is correct, we not only see why professional architects were prepared to go an extra mile in pursuing or confirming their identity, being perhaps profoundly intrigued, we also have some idea of where that confirmation could have taken place. In Vaughan's famous engraving of Elias Ashmole by Vaughan, the supplicant to the master is being asked to accept something. He is not the one being accepted. Again, it must be stressed that he must take into himself appears to be something sacred. Hence, the appearance of heavenly characters in the engraving at the moment the secret or secrets are accepted. Now, of course, it is reasonable to object that the engraving for Ashmole's book is plainly a reference to that section of the book dealing with Sir Thomas Norton's Ordinal of Alchemy, a 15th century work which Ashmole wished to bring to the attention of his 17th century readers. In other words, the engraving has nothing to do with Freemasonry at all in any context. It is to do with alchemy and only alchemy. However, several other factors might give us pause before we are too readily adopt a path of justifiable skepticism. First, in Norton's Ordinal, as published by Ashmole, the alchemist author Norton makes the point that among other trades, Freemasons have not been reluctant to take an interest in and practical value from alchemy. They weren't reluctant. There was in the 15th century a recognized link between Freemasons and the happy pursuit of alchemy. This link is attested in other alchemical works where the male and female figures depicting the alchemical Sol and Luna, sun and moon, are seen carrying compasses and set square, respectively. It is also the case that during the 1650s and afterwards, Ashmole was himself the alchemical son of English gentleman alchemist Sir William Backhouse, as well as being an initiated Freemason. The connection between Freemasonry and alchemy could hardly have passed Ashmole by. The reason, the mention of the alchemical sun has to do with a ritual that an alchemical ritual that Ashmole went through to be accepted into a particular order, and the master of that order was William Backhouse. So that's what that notion of sun. Call me father was what he was asked to do, and he did. Father, son, see the connection? Second, the appearance of the blazing star above the checkered floor in Vaughan's engraving to Ashmole's alchemical masterpiece is itself highly suggestive. Well, of course. The earliest known English catechism makes special mention of the blazing star as a jewel of the lodge. The blazing star to this day is a significant symbolic image adorning most lodges throughout the world. It was the author of this book who discovered what appears to be the earliest reference to the blazing star in an almost certainly Masonic context. Again, the link is within the life of Elias Ashmole. Yes, I just a little bit on that. I'll add it on. In January 1652, the first copy of Ashmole's Theatrium Chemicum Britannicum was sold to Philip Hebert, the 5th Earl of Pembroke, recently promoted to the presidency of the nation's Council of State. This book was of significance to one of the most powerful men in Cromwell's England. It wasn't a gift. Pembroke actually paid for it. 8 months later, Ashmole made an extended journey to Staffordshire and Derbyshire. Near Buxton, Ashmole encountered a Mr. Allerinshaw, that's how you say it, who had studied at Cambridge. Ashmole noted in his diary that this man had given King James great satisfaction about the blazing star. It is a Masonic tradition that King James I was an admitted Freemason. Masonry in Scotland was reorganized during James' reign there by the king's master mason, William Scaw. Given great satisfaction on the subject, the most recondite subject may have been obtained in the context of something like a question and answer scenario. Masons were familiar with question and answer scenarios when being tested on their Masonic knowledge. We see that too. These scenarios are called catechisms and are still in widespread use today in lodge work. One of the earliest detailed accounts of the blazing star as a peculiarly Masonic symbol occurs in John Brown's Master Key, published in cipher, mind you, in 1790. I love that. According to Brown, the blazing star, the glory in the center, reminds us of that awful, awesome period when the Almighty delivered the two tablets of stone containing the Ten Commandments, note the stone reference, to his faithful servant Moses on Mount Sinai, when the rays of his divine glory shone so bright, with such effulgent splendor and unparalleled luster that none could behold it without fear or trembling. It is interesting that the appearance of the blazing star, representing the presence of God, appears when something is being accepted from an awesome source. If we may use the phrase lodge of exception with some caution, such an occasion would be realized when something sacred was taken within, accepted. Something special was to be held in sacred trust thereafter. If this interpretation is sound, then those who may have experienced such a thing surely keep the secret to themselves. Not only do we know practically nothing about anything imparted at the exception, but also it is quite possible that even the word itself, through ignorance of its proper reference, come to mean something quite different from its original intent. This lack of knowledge may, in part, account for the reference today in the third degree ritual material to the newly made Master Mason receiving only the substituted secrets. Because. The originals, according to the legend, went to the grave with the Master, Hiram Abiff, at the building of the temple at Jerusalem. This is every good reason not to take this gloss in its apparent historical sense. However, the allegorical death of Masonic hero Hiram Abiff may yet be significant with regard to trying to understand the 17th century lodge in which men experienced exception. This significance may be highlighted if we take the exception to be the particular point from which modern Freemasonry was projected, albeit unconsciously. See, I'm an accepted, free and accepted Mason because I have accepted something into my life, my spirit, my soul. And I can't, it's unspeakable because it's an experience. Greatest secret of all. How do I convey that sense? How do you convey that sense of the experience that you had? It's yours. It's personal. And it's defined as much by your temperament and personality and your abilities. It's beautiful. Every moment and every event in every man's life on earth plants something in his soul. So this is entirely plausible. That comes from somebody that I admire a great deal, Thomas Merton. If we are not at peace with others because we are not at peace with ourselves. And we are not at peace with ourselves because we are not at peace with God. You know, it does tend to make us a bit humble. And the biggest human temptation is to settle for too little. Pride makes us artificial and humility makes us real. Nothing like a bit of artificial to start the day. I do think more than ever, you know, I'm reading some material on, it's a book called Quiet, and it's about introverts. One of the topics has been studied thin over the years by psychology has been this notion of introvert and extrovert. Now, think about it. Introvert, if you look around, and I think coterminously, the introvert is the contemplative mind. One in two or one in three people that we see around us is an introvert. However they handle it, you know, what they display is different. But intrinsically, they will be the introvert, the thoughtful person. In the last analysis, the individual person is responsible for living his own life and for finding himself. If he persists in shifting his responsibility to somebody else, he fails to find out the meaning of his own existence. There you have Thomas Merton. And I think it fits well into this segue. We do well as Freemasons. We pulled together a great many facts, historical facts, with credible opinion, and it's like a tea. All of these ingredients we put into the pot and we let them percolate a little bit, and then we sip it. Now, is it to say that there's only one type of flavor that's really quite excellent? Or is it to say that my taste may change and I may like another flavor in a year from now? A Freemasonry is similar. How you get there, the destination, there's many paths, many, many, many paths. So if anybody was to come along and say, you know, this is the interpretation of the world as we know it, I don't know if we should buy it. I hope I've been useful today. I really do. I hope I've been entertaining. Don't judge each day by the harvest you reap, but by the plant seeds that you plant. Robert Louis Stevenson said that. Find a place inside where there's joy, and the joy will burn out the pain. When you hear the fellow that's complaining and so critical, so negative of you and the world around, just remember that he's twice as critical and pained the way he treats himself. We can't help him in that isolation. He has to do that for himself. But here's how. Joseph Campbell, lovely, lovely fellow. To all of you who are out there, we're coming up to, I hope you're bringing that bearing of Christmas joy and spirit from you to impact the world around you. If you're expecting that the experience is going to be there, and then you'll start to feel better, go over to the shadows and stand there and get out of the way, because you never, never, ever, that's not the way the world works. If you want something to happen, you make it happen. If you want that joy and contentment, you make it happen. It comes from the influence of you. Happiness is not something you postpone for the future. It is something you design for the present. So you want that joy that you felt with that childlike release, that carefree feeling at Christmas? Make it happen. You bring that spirit to the people that come in contact with you, to wherever you are, to your own heart, to your own mind, and do it in Masonic fashion. That's the most interesting part, this capability to constant renewal. If you accept the expectations of others, especially negative ones, then you never will change the outcome. Your present circumstances don't determine where you can go. They merely determine where you start. Believe you can, and you're halfway there. That last part, it's Theodore Roosevelt. Change your thoughts, and you change your world. Bring Christmas from your heart to the world around you, and make that commit random acts of Masonic kindness. I hope I'll see you, and we'll join up next week on Masonic Companion. Hope it's been useful to you. Thanks for all your support. It's wonderful. Bye.